This is where that little slide is.
Good. Can we kick off?
Okay, yeah. Welcome all. Thank you for coming on this pleasant evening to this lecture, to this public event that's co-organized by the sociology department of the LSE with Radix, the think tank. And I am Neil Munslin, member of the sociology department, and also somewhat involved with Radix. And before I give the word to the speakers who will present and some ideas from this book today, let me very briefly maybe say a few words on why we organized this event and who the speakers are. So maybe I should just say how I got involved, because this somehow maybe explains why this event takes place. I met Joe Lucia just about a year ago, exactly a year ago in Weimar, and that was an academic event on the politics of central banking. And what struck me is that Joe was the only one who actually asked questions earnestly, in the sense that he actually wanted answers, and he also took sort of suggested ideas without preconceptions of what, you know, what a proper worldview is, very open-mindedly, in contrast to the academics, to most of the academics in the audience, who tend to adopt a different strategy of, you know, no matter what the others say, I sort of confirm my own views. So that was very refreshing. He was also the last one who would still be up for drinks in the evening. So that was part of the sort of that partly allows for the exchange to be lively. So that's how it started, and then we had a couple of conversations, very open-mindedly about various topics that he and I are interested in, like the European Union. That's a very big issue for Radix, which is a think tank in the UK, but also sort of spreads out to other European countries. They have a branch now in Italy and in
Spain.
And maybe Germany.
Yes.
So there is a strong, that's one of the strong issues that Radix is focused on. But maybe the sort of ideas behind Radix, I'm not the best one to explain that. Maybe David and Joe can do so as part of that talk, or maybe in the Q&A. Anyway, today we are going to talk about globalization, or more specifically, the politics, economics, culture of trade in relation to this book. And maybe one of the things I just wanted to say at the start is why we organized this, or why it makes sense that we organize this in the sociology department and not in economics or government department here at LSE. I mean, it obviously has some pragmatic reasons, but maybe also there is an opportunity in this. The opportunity being, as you emphasized in your book, is that maybe sociology is more open of thinking about trade in different terms than economists, who have certain preconceptions of the kinds of analytic frameworks through which you view trade. And I think that sort of the whole critique of certain kind of economics is very strong in the book, and I find very interesting, which is, by the way, also part of what we do in economic sociology here, so to engage with economics, hopefully sort of in an informed way, but also in a critical way, and sort of debunk some of the assumptions underlying macroeconomics. And then, of course, also, why not in the government department? I think because you very nicely argue in this book, and we'll, I guess, talk more about it later, that trade, as you just also emphasized, is not just a very narrow policy issue, but has broader implications, and I think you very nicely discuss in the book the sort of cultural, social changes associated with different attitudes towards trade, different engagements with the economy more broadly, that maybe are the background from which we could discuss trade policy in different terms than has been done in the past. And so I think in that respect it makes a great deal of sense to be discussing this in the sociology department. The speakers are as I said already, Joe and David. And maybe I should just say a few words on both of them. So David Boyle is one of the co-founders of Radix. He has published other books as well on equally sort of very controversial or, controversial or interesting issues like one has a very nice title, at least from a sociology point of view, The Tyranny of Numbers. Very nice title. He's also been involved with the Liberal Party in the UK as a parliamentary candidate, as I understand.
It's true. It's true. Sorry, it's true.
Yeah, it's true. Okay, and he runs the Radix blog. So everybody interested in the kind of breadth of what Radix does, have a look at the website, which is very active. It's very sort of, there's always something new blog posts, new reports, and so forth. And Joe, as I said, is also a co-founder of Radix, and also publishes on different issues, also on the website, also Huffington Post, other forums, sort of reflecting his open-mindedness to some extent and his interest in engaging in public debate, and obviously he's also behind developing, both of them are behind developing Radix more, because it's a very recent think tank that is expanding and growing. So I don't dare to say anything about your other professional backgrounds, but you have a doctorate degree in?
Medicine.
So that is, well, it's a certain path of Joe that maybe we can get into later, but clearly he is a very much also the spirit behind Radix. Okay, so we are going to discuss this book, Backlash, Saving Globalization from Itself, which was published last month? Or this
today.
Today, okay, so this is actually the book launch. I've read the book, obviously, you couldn't, so what we will do is, because it's just out today, so what we'll do is we decided that we give some more time for presenting the book. Joe is going to speak for about 25 minutes, and then you are going to speak for roughly 10, 15 minutes, something like that. And then we have Q&A, and we will record the event, and we'll hopefully... So we are just a few in this room, but there will be more following this event online, I guess. And so please make very intelligent remarks and ask intelligent questions so that we have something to advertise on this recorder, and yeah, I look forward to the presentation and the discussion.
Excellent. Thank you, Leon. Okay, let me see. Yes. Thank you, Leon. David and I are honored to be presenting here at this eminent institution. Thank you for coming. Thank you for organizing it, and thank Emma for being so wonderfully efficient in organizing everything. And as Leon said, we are particularly pleased to be doing this in the Department of Sociology because so many of our intractable problems today seem to be hogged by economists. and even if they're fundamentally social and political issues. And therefore should be approached with a broader perspective than a merely economic one. And today we're here to talk about globalization, and in particular, its future. I know that future predictions are not particularly wise at this particular time in our political lives, but anyway, we'll talk a little bit about that. Globalization is a big word. I mean, for one thing, it's got 13 letters.
Whereas the average English language
word has 5 letters, so it's a big word. And it encompasses a number of things. There's obviously the cross-fertilization of cultures, mutual understanding. That's an important part of globalization, as you all experience every day in this institution. And then there's trade, international trade. And the view we take in this book that all of these aspects of globalization are essentially under threat today. And what I'd like to do... Hi, come on in. Have a seat. What I'd like to do is to examine why these aspects of globalization are under threat. Why is the concept of globalization that until quite recently was seen as an unalloyed good thing suddenly no longer seen like that? It now seems to be risking being shunted into reverse gear. And is there anything we can do about it, or maybe even question, is there anything we should try to be doing about it? I'll spend most of my time talking about the why we're seeing these changes rather than the remedies. And the reason for that is that, back to my past, before reaching for our prescription pad, we should all make sure that we have the diagnosis right. Otherwise, we'll do more harm than good. And in my view, we've not really spent enough time talking about the diagnosis. Secondly, finding the right prescription is far from easy, which is why I'm going to leave that part to David to talk after I've finished. We make some initial suggestions in the book, but we don't pretend to have the answer. And frankly, neither does anyone else. But if responses are to be found, they need to be built on a clear understanding, at least a shared understanding, of what may be the things that are going wrong. So what is going on? So I'd like to start by telling a tale of angels and demons, heroes and villains. We all love tales of angels and demons. They've enchanted us over the ages in fiction, in Hollywood movies, and particularly since we all tend to fall for them when we persuade ourselves that we're on the side of the angels. but these tales, I think, are best left where they belong, which is in the world of fiction and escapism. And it is dangerous to apply this mindset to the messy world of realpolitik. So I'd like to start by going back to November 2017, the G20 meeting in Hamburg. Chancellor Merkel and President Xi present themselves center stage at that meeting as the defenders of free trade and the prosperity it has brought to billions of people. And that is a key element in the narrative that is now in circulation and that we are expected to believe, that Germany and China are essentially the angels of the peace. They are the defenders of free trade as we know it. And we all want free trade, right? And then we have the new demon of the peace, President Trump, the person who's throwing up in the air the post-war world order and the prosperity it has brought. This is the narrative that we are asked to believe. It's attractive. It fulfills what psychologists call cognitive ease. In other words, it appeals to our preconceived ideas. And, you know, when faced with Germany and the China that have been supremely successful, and let's face it, we all envy them a little bit, then, you know, in that corner lie the heroes. And at the other corner, we have a US president who, if I may put it like that, doesn't go out of his way to try to be liked. So the angels and demons narrative makes intuitive sense. It appeals to what Daniel Kahneman calls system one thinking, our intuitive thinking that comes very quickly, fast thinking. We hear a narrative, it appeals to us, we make a quick intuitive decision that we like it, especially if it flatters us. And we accept it without having to do the hard work of system two analytical thinking. The trouble is that much of what our system one thinking accepts actually turns out to be wrong. So just to put forward one chart, China and Germany have actually been the two countries that have, over the last decade, implemented the most the greatest number of restrictive trade policies. As Benjamin Franklin put it, another American, one of the greatest tragedies in life is the murder of a beautiful theory by a gang of brutal facts. So my aim today is to get out of simply accepting the narrative that has been fed to us, to help us do a little bit more of hard thinking about what is actually going on, and to try and create a new narrative. Now, I promise that this slide is not the ultimate aim of my presentation. And the reason is that there are no angels and there are no demons. There are just leaders and countries trying to do what they believe is best. And the reality is that none of us knows what that is. Learned papers can be published with all sorts of seemingly elegant solutions. But when they hit the inelegant and very challenging world of real politics, the real trade-offs that affect people's lives, then none of it seems quite so elegant or simple. But one thing is for sure, that the world is changing very rapidly before our eyes, and it has changed out of all recognition from when the post-war world order was put together, when all the current structures of globalization were put in place. And it continues to change at a very rapid pace, much more rapidly than our institutions can change. And those changes I will address can be divided into political, cultural, and economic. It's an interesting font that's appeared there. Okay. So let's start with the political. And why do I want to start with the political? Because although trade is often discussed in economic terms, trade is actually politics. We cannot understand trade unless first we take a political perspective. We argue in the book that trade is not an end in itself, but it's merely an instrument of domestic and foreign policy. So it may be true that trade overall increases welfare, and as such, it is one of the many tools that government can use to increase welfare. They then have to trade that off against other ways they might increase welfare. They need to look at how that welfare is spread, who gains, who loses, what are the social, cultural, and political implications of all these decisions. Similarly, trade can be used as a way to project power. We see that today more than we've seen it for a while. But again, it's one of many ways in which power can be projected. So all of this to say that the standard 20th century narrative that international trade increases welfare and is an absolute good, and as the Spanish would say, ya está, that's it, no room for discussion, is much too simplistic. And we'll come to that later. So if we're going to talk politics, how has the world geopolitical structure changed? And what are the implications for globalization? So the post-war world, which spawned the institutions of globalization, was characterized by what we know as the Washington Consensus. We had a globalization overseen by global governance structures, the Bretton Woods institutions, and the whole thing was steered by the hegemonic power of the United States. Apart from the USSR, that chose to close itself off from the world, we had one single power, the US. And it steered the whole thing, and everybody largely followed and benefited. And Western liberal democracy was seen as the aspirational goal for everybody. We believed that everybody wanted to become a liberal democracy. Well, none of this is true anymore. The first major change is that the idea of global governance is no longer widely accepted. We're seeing the resurgence of the nation state as where is the legitimate locus of democracy. The Bretton Woods institutions are no longer seen as legitimate, and their power is waning. They're seen by the developing world as still dominated by the West in terms of governance, and they're seen by the West that even though we dominate them, they don't actually serve us as well as they used to. In terms of trade, we now see a world no longer dominated by the US, but rather evolving into three major trading blocs. The US, the EU and China, each with their spheres of influence. China's success, a revanchist Russia, the rise of the political strongman in countries like Turkey, the rejection of democracy as a goal in Middle Eastern countries, the invention within our own European Union of illiberal democracy. All these things have put to bed, at least for the moment, the idea that globalization of a single political structure, that of liberal democracy, is where the future is going. As regards trade, the 20th century narrative was that of the spread of prosperity through free trade. This led to the rise of the multinational model, an efficient structure that could optimize performance by cherry-picking the best of what each country had to offer. In terms of economic efficiency, in that narrow term, it was a tremendously positive development. And now we have the political backlash. What was seen as a model of economic efficiency is now seen as an instrument of arbitrage in jobs, taxes, and investment. In other words, multinational corporations are seen as playing off one country against the other, driving a race to the bottom, and developing more political power than legitimately elected governments. In other words, some believe that we're moving from a democracy to a plutocracy. And finally, national security. Once again, we used to live in a world where the US essentially underwrote global security. We lived in a prosperous, peaceful world where we could just trade with each other and our security was guaranteed by the American taxpayer. No longer. And no longer are trade and security separate issues. The US worries about electronics made in China that may have back doors that are a threat to security. As we move to a largely digital economy, everyone is concerned about the security threats posed by hacking, even in areas that were previously thought to have little to do with national security. The CEO of Baidu put it like this: "The days where a car was made in one place and sold everywhere are over, because a car that can drive itself is by definition a weapon." Who would have thought a few years ago that trade in cars would become a national security issue? And of course, China has its own views about the relationship between data, free flow of information, and national security. So with all these developments, it's been known since the 1980s that such a structure is much more likely to see competition between blocs than the sort of multilateral collaboration that characterized the second half of the 20th century. And that's exactly what we're seeing. Like in nature, international trade has always been a delicate dance between collaboration and competition. And the tune of that dance has changed. So the cause of the competition we are seeing before our very eyes is geopolitical structures that have changed, not, as some would have us believe, a US that has suddenly gone out of control. And it was all predictable, and it was all predicted. Then there are the cultural changes. And these are vitally important to trade. Why? There was a time when the main barrier to trade was tariffs. You can pay tariffs, it's just money. No longer. Now the main barrier to trade is regulatory divergence and regulatory barriers. and regulation reflects local norms and local cultures. So trade, as well as other aspects of globalization, like the movement of people, inevitably starts impinging on local sensitivities and local cultural norms. So for decades, multiculturalism was the order of the day. Free movement of people was a good thing. It mingles skills and cultures, it brings benefits and mutual understanding. In other words, the late 20th century narrative was one of cultural and religious coexistence. Multiculturalism was going to be opened up by global communication and social media platforms, and all these things would be a force for good and build mutual understanding amongst peoples. I don't need to tell you that all of that has changed. Now, the focus is on social cohesion as vital to the solidarity without which democracies cannot function. We live in a world of identity politics, whether that identity is underpinned by religion, nation, or political positions like pro or anti-Brexit. We are, one way or another, living in a time of culture wars rather than multiculturalism. Now we worry about the threats from global communications. We start to see that social media platforms can be agents of hate and division just as much as they can be catalysts of mutual understanding. We worry about privacy and the abuse of personal data, fake news, interference in elections, the national security implications of the uncontrollable world of personal data. So all these things have changed fundamentally from when we built the post-war, not we, when they built the post-war structures. Then comes consumption. So globalization was built on the idea of defining human beings as one thing and one thing only. We were all consumers. Last weekend, I was stuck in an airport for a lot longer than I would have liked. So I wandered around and took these pictures. So this is what globalization has brought to us, if we choose to define ourselves as consumers. We can now consume as much of this sort of tat and rubbish as we like, because it's made in China. It's cheap. We can buy tons of it, throw it away, and buy the next lot. This, I guess, is one part of the definition of welfare in economic terms. But again, this is all changing. The idea that welfare is largely defined by consumption is maybe not quite evaporating, but it's certainly a bit weak at the knees. Many people are feeling that there may be a little bit more to life than buying this stuff. And we're also starting to wonder if it's true that anything goes just so that we can get a penny off. So we're starting to be concerned about the labor conditions that underpin our $1,000 iPhones. Yes, we are told by the defenders of free trade that there are ILO guidelines. We're told that companies have their own internal guidelines about labor conditions in different countries. But we all know that none of it is enforced and none of it is true. We're starting to be concerned by the environmental damage wrought by the combination of a world of consumption, a finite planet, and that never-ending search for the penny off. I don't know if any of you have ever been to Madagascar, but it's one of the most wonderful and most sad places. These are images from Madagascar and the environmental destruction that's happened there, combined with the poorest of populations. And we're starting to wonder whether it really makes sense for components to have to travel three times around the globe to be finally assembled and shipped yet again to their final destination. The emissions from world shipping are focused to increase by 250% over the next decade or so. And we have no solution to it. So our economist friends call these externalities. It seems such an elegant and harmless word, yet culturally we seem less and less willing to put up with them. Finally, let's get to the economics. I like this statement from Professor Roderick of Harvard. Comparative advantage and the gains from trade. So let's examine them both in turn. On the left is David Ricardo, whose theory of comparative advantage underpins the whole concept of international trade. It's a very powerful theory, first published in 1817 and still ruling supreme. I'm not proposing that we throw it out, but would it not be reasonable to at least have a discussion about how much of it still applies in a 21st century world? Because we live in a world that would be totally unrecognizable to David Ricardo. In his time, comparative advantage lasted a very long time, not today. Technological advance happens rapidly, technology transfer happens in a flash, new skills and capabilities are built, old skills can be enhanced through technology and education. So in such a fast-moving world, is it reasonable to keep deindustrializing and throwing out skills built out over decades or centuries because some other country might have a comparative advantage in that particular area for the next 5 minutes? And Ricardo's theory was predicated on a constraint, the constraint of goods of equivalent quality. But what does that mean today? Today, we can hire a marketing agency to magic up a new definition of quality in 5 minutes. It's doubtful whether goods or services of equivalent quality actually exist anymore. Everything is differentiated, even if it's minor, and enveloped in a halo of marketing and advertising activity that forms part of our conception of quality. And of course, David Ricardo lived in a world that largely traded in goods, and today we live in a world that largely trades in services. So as I said, I'm not trying to throw out such a fundamental column of your economist colleague's edifice. But it's rather amazing how little discussion there is about what comparative advantage means in a 21st century world. How a 2 centuries-old theory is still somehow treated like some kind of religious dogma, never to be challenged without whoever tries to do that being labeled a heretic. And what about the second element in that quote up there, the gains from trade? Yes, there are gains, but there are also downsides. The institutions of globalization have, last year or the year before, I can't remember, come up with this statement that has been obvious to every factory worker in the world for the last 50 years. And we risk getting drawn into a world where, as long as our economic models throw out a number at the end that's a net positive, the social disruptions that are embedded in the workings of such models get ignored, or at the very least, not sufficiently valued. The reality is that the gains from trade have been highly asymmetrical. When I speak to people in the trade world about all this, I always get the same response. Job losses are not due to trade, they're due to technology. Well, that is plain wrong. Yes, there have been technological advancements, but they have also come from the asymmetrical gains and losses from international trade. It's not either or, it's also and. And we cannot keep persisting with a trade structure that results in such asymmetry. So in domestic policy terms, it's worth asking this question. Are the gains from trade worth the social, political, and economic downsides that they bring? For instance, one analysis... I'm not quite sure how to get back to it again. One analysis of the impact of NAFTA concluded that the net gain in US welfare was less than 0.1%. But vulnerable groups saw their wage growth fall by 17%. 17 percentage points, sorry. So if you were running a country with responsibility for the welfare of your citizens, the people who voted you in and whose taxes you collect, would you take this deal? Would you take a deal that gives you less than 0.1% of gain with very significant social disruptions? Or would you look for some other way to gain that 0.1%? Or maybe you wouldn't bother at all. It's, after all, minuscule. Let's talk about mercantilism. The idea that trade was about exports. The more you exported, the wealthier you got, the more gold in your coffers. And in the mercantilist's mind, trade was all about exports. But in the 20th century, mercantilism was considered a dirty word. We were all supposed to import and export and not worry about the balance and or imbalance of trade. That's another thing we were fed. But in reality, the mercantilist mentality never really went away. Do you think Germany and China would really be standing up so aggressively for the current trade system if they had a huge trade deficit rather than a huge trade surplus? You really believe it? It's interesting. Some work done in emerging markets asked people whether they believed in world trade. Everybody said, yeah, we do believe it. Then they asked the same people, so do you believe that your country should be importing stuff from other countries? And nobody wanted that. So in people's minds, it's all about exports. That's what the mercantilist mentality is alive and well and always has been. And now we understand that large unidirectional trade imbalances are simply not sustainable. They're not sustainable politically, they're not sustainable socially, and they're not sustainable economically. Somehow people have to pay for those trade imbalances. And they can only do that by borrowing foreign money or by selling all their assets to other countries. You know, economists, like, how many economists there are here, but they like to say that trade imbalances are caused by macroeconomic factors. I apologize, but I have difficulty making sense of that. And while I can see an association, I can't really understand how one works out which way the causation goes. Finally, last element, let's talk about money. Many trade deals contain within them the liberalization of the capital account. But the free flow of capital is certainly not what I understand by trade. We need to separate flow of capital from trade and financial services, which are two very different things. And the two are often lumped in one convenient box, but they are fundamentally different issues. So the free flow of capital was intended to be the underpinning of investment and growth. And to an extent, that has happened. But today we recognize that the daily flow of many trillions of dollars around the globe brings not only benefits, but also some issues. First of all, we're all struggling with the flow of illicit money and money laundering. And the greater the free flow of capital, the more that is facilitated. We're also struggling with how to deal with tax arbitrage. I've mentioned before that one of the challenges of free trade is asymmetry in costs and benefits between different parts of the population. And the free trade, the people who support the free trade system say, well, that's okay, because that should be made up through the welfare system. But you can't make it up through the welfare system while, you know, corporations can engage in tax arbitrage and not pay any tax. You can't have it both ways. So we are ever more unable to use the welfare system as a cushion. But maybe most important is the destabilizing effect of the flow of so-called hot money. Money that flows in large sums to economies when they're seen to be on the up and disappears overnight and just as quickly whenever they hit a bump. So again, even the IMF has now finally accepted that liberalization of the capital account may not be always appropriate. It's something to be treated with caution, and the issues of this hot money flow are, of course, amplified in a very low-interest world. So what does all this mean? Are we moving back towards a world of localism? If I had put this slide up a couple of years ago, you would have said this must be some kind of hippie poster that he's dug up from somewhere. So it may surprise you that the Davos crowd has become enchanted with the idea of localism. And there are many other forces pushing in that direction also. More and more companies are looking at closed-loop supply chains, or what is also called the circular economy. And such a thing is not viable and probably pretty pointless if supply chains remain distributed around the globe. Mass-produced goods are no longer the only future. Of course, they remain an important part of business, but increasingly we're all looking for tailored goods and services, and even seeing the rise of co-production, one of David's favorite subjects. None of that is viable if everything is scattered around the globe. And of course, we're all still struggling to work out what on earth a digital economy will look like. Once seen as a facilitator of globalization, we now understand the issues with monopoly power of network effects, data privacy, security, and what we're seeing is, in fact, the balkanization of data rather than globalization of data. So where does this all get us? The challenge is to overcome our current tendency to polarization, where so-called defenders of free trade fold their arms and insist that things must stay exactly the same, and others think the whole thing is unfair, a total mess, and must be torn down. The view we express in our book is this one, that the current free trade structures, their 20th century creation based on 19th century economics, and they are no longer fit for purpose in a 21st century world. But we mustn't throw them out. We must reform them, and we must find ways to reimagine what it could look like. The trouble, of course, is that institutions avoid change like the plague. They're always comfortable with the status quo, and some, like this gentleman here, argue that only deep and severe crises ever cause massive institutions to change. So let me offer some hope, and let me suggest that it might just come from the most unexpected corner. Is it possible that President Trump is actually the disruptive force that we need to force change? Is it possible that it will take a credible US threat to bring down the whole system before anybody will contemplate changing our institutions to make them fit for the 21st century. Of course, President Trump and his team, as we know, and as we've seen, doesn't have the answers to what is a complex issue. And nobody does. But he has at least forced a different discussion, both with China and with the EU. Maybe something positive will come of it. Who knows? So all that to say that I want to end with a different narrative to the one that we've been being fed. That you know, there are these defenders of free trade that are fighting to keep the status quo that has served us well. I'll pass on to David, and in passing on, I'll leave you with this quote that with which we open our book that David dug out from a 1933 speech made by Keynes.
Thank you, Joe. Yes, well, I'm only going to do two things, and neither of them really are going to give you the answers, I'm afraid. First of all, I'm going to talk about the links between the anti-slavery movement in the 19th century and free trade, and where it should have gone, where it didn't go. And then I'm going to talk about some things we might do. Actually, I'm going to mention Joe's shoes, because there's a link between Joe's shoes and globalization. Do you know what it is? Think of the Wizard of Oz. You see, you click your fingers, your shoes together, and you go wherever you like. That's what Dorothy was told. She had red shoes. It's an interesting thought. It struck me as I was, should have been thinking more closely about what he was saying. So where was I? Yes, well, let me tell you quickly about this quote. This was a quotation from Keynes, who was invited to address the Irish government in 1933 on a title called National Self-Sufficiency. That very title, I think, is probably the reason why none of us read this, because it's not well known in Keynesian circles. It's rather discouraged, actually. It's the most fantastic speech, actually. It includes the phrase about how we're capable of shutting down the sun and the stars because they pay no dividends. I think is an interesting and rather inspiring thought. Perhaps not so inspiring, actually, if you think what he's trying to tell us. It's an inspiring speech where he considers the possibility and the importance, so occasionally, of making things local. Art, hospitality, he says those things have got to be international. Other things, money, he says, has got to primarily be national. And then there's, he says here, yes. Anyway, it's the reason we don't know about these things. Well, let me quickly just say the other two things I was going to say. Because it is one of the great ironies of history that the liberation of the agricultural slaves and serfs happened almost at the same time. I don't know if you knew this. 1863. Both the fields of Russia and the plantations of the southern US states. The slaves were freed by Abraham Lincoln in 1863 by the Emancipation Declaration. It took another 2 years to win the Civil War and finish the job. And then the serfs were freed in March 1861. Great cheers outside the Royal Palace in St. Petersburg when the Tsar announced it. Again, it took 2 years. Finally came to fruition in February 1863, 5 weeks after Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation. They were great victories in the anti-slavery campaigners. More than half a century since the first success of the campaign against the slave trade. They were also great defeats, of course, because in both cases the slaves and the serfs found themselves back into debt bondage and into poverty. Peonage. And in Russia, the land was valued at 3.5 times its market value. They had to pay their former owners for their land over a period of 49 years. It's hardly surprising that when the details weren't even agreed for many decades, many of them didn't. And just in the same way, many of the serfs were thrown on the mercy of the London moneylenders. It wasn't really enough to release the slaves. They also had to release them from debt and monopoly. Now, what's the connection between that and free trade? Well, it seems to me that the anti-slavery campaigners at that stage were the free trade campaigners. But Cobden and who took over the mantle by from Ricardo, who we saw a little bit earlier, had that very much in mind. It was an extension of the anti-slavery campaign, the campaign for free trade. Cobden died in 1865, so he hardly lived to see it. But he knew what the economic manacles were. He could bind the slaves very closely. Just as England, the Corn Laws forced the poor to buy a bed at inflated prices. So I think the point here is that free trade wasn't just a simple license to do whatever you want, you were rich enough. It's people who were aware thoroughly that free trade in those wrong hands could be a conspiracy against the public. It was designed as a means of liberation, so as the small could challenge the big. The poor could challenge the rich. This is Shunter-esque approach, and suddenly I was just reading about Shunter. Did you know Shunter had three great ambitions of being his life? This is the side, I'm afraid. Three great ambitions. He wanted to be the greatest economist in the world, the greatest horseman in Austria, and the greatest lover in Vienna. And towards the end of his life, he said he managed to achieve two of them, but not the third. He never said what the third one was, which he failed to achieve. That's entirely beside the point. So somehow, our conception of free trade 100 years on, 150 years on from that, is completely the reverse of it. It's now no longer a means by which you could supposed to challenge the monopolies. It's an apology for the monopolies. And therein, it seems to me, lies the basic dilemma. And why I think free trade needs to be shaken up a little bit, more than a little bit. So something went wrong when Friedrich Hayek wrote The Road to Serfdom in 1944. He was thinking about a very different conception of free trade. And then, I don't know if you know the history of this, but eventually it was the Americans raised the money to write a version of The Road to Serfdom themselves. And three economists, all from Chicago, all bitterly infighting against each other, tried to start, and only one of them managed to finish. That was Milton Friedman, published in 1963. By the time under the hands of Milton Friedman, the whole concept of free trade had changed because he denied the existence of monopoly. He said it was no problem. And when it was a problem, it was the state's fault. So the whole thing has then shifted over in ways that we're now living with now. I think the political crisis we face now is linked to these issues. Brexit and the Trump phenomenon, I'm not quite as keen on Trump as Joe appeared to be, I know he's not really as keen on Trump as all that, were driven by the discontent of globalisation and free trade, as it's been interpreted by the current global elite. The reaction has been deeply damaging, but it paradoxically provides us with a glimmer of hope that one day a new kind of trade deal might look forward to a different understanding of free trade. It's more in tune with its roots than it currently is. So I may say this book began out of an idea that we had, what we imagined to ourselves, what would a free trade deal look like with America, with Trump, that would be widely welcomed by all sides of the debate and would revolutionise free trade in a real sense. And of course, the moment you start thinking about it, you realise that Trump would never agree to it. Or perhaps he would one morning because he'd have a whim. You know what he might have tweeted the night before. Suddenly find, gosh, I've agreed to this thing and he has to go for it. But that's not the point here. The point is, can you imagine a free trade deal that would satisfy some of these ambitions, some of the things that Joe talks about? Because if even Trump doesn't accept it now, I think that if there is a way forward for free trade, and I believe there is, then it may form the basis in the next generation of what those trading blocks will look like, what those trade agreements will look like. Bearing in mind, of course, that any kind of free trade is also limited to sovereignty, which we also forget, rather. So, let me say our 6 points, and then I'll leave it. The 6 points of this new, revolutionary new free trade deal, which we're going to do with anybody who asks us very nicely. The first needs to fit within an overall policy framework, as Joe said. Trade policy should be the instruments of countries' domestic and foreign policies. You want them to formulate their trade policies to achieve their domestic and foreign policy goals and not the other way around. The trade tail can't wag the domestic and foreign policy dog. That's the first one. Second, it needs to be flexible, it needs to be incremental. You can't do the whole thing at once. If it's about regulation, as it is, as Joe said, you can't suddenly solve those differences overnight. What you can do is set out a direction of travel. Start with the easier sectors and you start a process of alignment, which may take decades, it may take longer than decades. There may be areas you never get to, but nonetheless you start out. Third, and it seems to me this is crucial to what I was saying before, it needs to concentrate on helping the small and medium-sized enterprises, not just the big multinationals, who are really, let's face it, the only beneficiaries from the current round of trade deals. We suggest them how this might be done in the book. Fourth, they need to focus on trade rather than investment. And really, let's face it, trade deals these days are more about protection of investor rights than it's about free trade. I'm not saying that investor rights shouldn't be protected. We don't want them to be subject to any special protection. In particular, it doesn't seem to me that investor-state dispute systems have any legitimacy in the law. Well, the sooner they go, the better. Better for everybody in the democratic input into these kind of things. And fifth, they need to encourage innovation rather than oligopoly. They need to strengthen competition and not reduce it. At the moment, they're reducing it. And finally, they need to build cultural and what I would say university links. Maybe we might have free movement again one day across the world, but let's start somewhere. Let's start with the links between universities, between students, between cultures, between artists, just as Keynes says here. Ideas, knowledge, science, hospitality, travel. These things of their nature should be international. That's the underpinning. If you don't have that, you really have nothing, it seems to me. So will Donald Trump grasp this opportunity and negotiate along these lines? I don't think he probably will. But if he doesn't, then somebody else will do. And when they do, I think they'll bring trade more into line with what people actually want and need. They'll also bring it more into line, it seems to me, with the original conception of free trade. That's all I was going to say. Thank you very much.